Good evening, everyone. I'm Lenore Moudou, and welcome to Health Chat. Every year, millions of people around the world receive blood to save their lives. Others donate their blood. Blood transfusions are used to replace blood lost during surgery or a serious injury. A transfusion also might be done if your body can't make blood properly because of an illness. While common and safe, a blood transfusion does present some challenges. We will discuss those challenges on the program today and look at what the procedure entails. Joining us via phone from the United States National Institute of Health headquarters in Bethesda, Maryland, right outside Washington, D.C., is Dr. Tracy Mondoro, Deputy Branch Chief of the Transfusion Medicine and Cellular Therapeutics Branch, Division of Blood Diseases and Resources of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. Dr. Mondoro, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And also joining us via phone from South Africa is Dr. Greg Bellers. He is the CEO and Medical Director of WP Blood Transfusion Services in Western Cape, South Africa. Dr. Bellers, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And we will be joined very shortly by Professor Imelda Bates with the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine in a moment. But first, let me remind the listeners, if you would like to participate in the show with your questions or comments, call 202-619-3111. The U.S. country code is 1. You can ask your international operator to reverse the charges. You can also email us your thoughts and questions at healthchat@voanews.com or post them on facebook.com/healthchat. We will discuss blood transfusion in a moment with our experts, but first, Voice of America's Moki Kinzeka reports on Cameroon's blood bank crisis.
For the past 3 years, the General Hospital in Yaoundé has not been able to fill 40% of its 75,000 blood bags. The consequence is that many patients in the hospital are asked to bring their family members to donate blood. Nelson Tawi has a sick relative who needed blood. He says a friend who was asked to donate was unable to help because his blood was tainted.
It's very, very bad. It's a very bad experience I had. We were told that the blood was infected with hepatitis. Imagine that the blood had not been tested. My relative would have been infected with hepatitis. I don't know which of the hepatitis, but it is God's mercy that keeps us on the safe side most of the time.
Dr. Biwole Sida, an official at the hospital, told VOA that many people in Cameroon are now afraid to donate blood because they must first be tested for hepatitis, which remains a major health problem in the country.
S'agissant des hépatites virales au Cameroun, nous avons des prévalences qui varient entre...
Dr. Sida says the prevalence rate in Cameroon for hepatitis B and C varies between 10 and 13%. Ndasi Elvis, a popular doctor in Cameroon who owns a private clinic, says hepatitis has only added to a long list of reasons why blood supplies are dwindling.
So you see, if hepatitis B is already at 10 to 13% prevalence rate and HIV is at 5.4, then you can imagine that this would actually reduce the number of qualified blood that would have been used for transfusion.
Dr. Elvis adds that he knows many patients who have died in hospitals because there was no blood to give them.
When you go to a hospital when you are severely anemic and there is no blood in the blood bank and there is nobody ready to donate blood at that point in time, then you are left with nothing but, you know, death. If you go through, you see each one family or the other must have suffered the fate of losing somebody because there was no blood.
Local grassroots associations are being created in the country to help contribute to the blood supply. Cyril Ngaska leads one of such associations.
We created this association to help hospitals and people in need of blood. Imagine that people die because they do not have blood. We contribute blood donated by our members and give the blood to those in need.
Some healthcare officials say the main reason why people do not donate blood is the fear of knowing their serological status and if they are infected with hepatitis. Cameroon's Minister of Public Health Andre Mamafuda has been piloting a campaign for people, especially the youth, to accept being tested.
Pour tous les jeunes qui ne connaissent pas encore leur statut, je leur demande de faire le test. Ceux qui seront déclarés positifs.
Fuda says he urges all young people who have not done so to get tested for HIV. He says if the results are positive, do not be discouraged. Follow the advice given by your doctors and you shall be taken care of. For those of you who are tested negative, maintain your serological status so as to create harmony when you get married. As Cameroon's population has increased, so has the need for blood. The country's population today is about 22 million people. Also, the number of accidents have drastically increased with about 100 reported each month. Last year, about 1,500 people died of road accidents in Cameroon, according to figures published by the country's Ministry of Transport. Moki Edwin Kinzika, VOA News, Yaoundé.
And again, now we are joined by Professor Imelda Bates. She's Professor of Tropical Hematology and Head of the Department of International Public Health at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. Professor Bates, thank you for joining the discussion.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Now, you and other experts, you probably did not hear the full report. So let me start with Dr. Belerge. You heard about the issues of getting blood or receiving blood in Cameroon, which is obviously an issue that is not just specific to that country. Can you tell us about the landscape in your region, your part of Africa, Western Cape, South Africa? How is the issue there with regards to blood transfusion?
Okay, yeah, I certainly can tell you about that. Our blood service covers the Greater Western Cape area, which is a province of South Africa. Around about 5 million people in the province, largely concentrated in two or three metropolitan areas. And we collect blood from voluntary, non-remunerated blood donors throughout the area and then supply blood to the hospitals via various blood banks. All the blood in our area is tested. We do individual donation nucleic acid testing, and we test for HIV, hepatitis B, and hepatitis C. And we've got a multi-layered safety strategy, which starts with the blood donor questionnaire and continues through to testing and also selecting low-risk populations as donors.
Okay, so safety is definitely an issue that is important when we talk about blood donation. I know many people are thinking about this. That's the very first thought when we talk about giving blood. Now, Professor Bates, you are through your organization trying to improve the blood transfusion in Africa. Tell us how you're trying to do that.
Well, we have a four-year funded project from the European Union in which we are trying to support blood transfusion services in Ghana and Zimbabwe to build up the number of people in the service that are able to do research into blood transfusion issues. And the reason that we're doing that is because that there are very, very few researchers in blood transfusion in Africa. And so many of the policies that the transfusion services are using have to be based on evidence from much more wealthy countries. And often this evidence is not appropriate. And so we're trying to improve the research ability within the transfusion services so that they can generate their own evidence to improve their own policies and practices within the region.
Okay. Now, Dr. Mondoro, you heard Dr. Bates and Dr. Belair talk about, perhaps give us a sense of what's going on in Africa. Here in the United States, do you see some similarities, some commonalities with some of the issues that Professor Bates raised in terms of access to blood?
So I think that the, finding donors is sometimes a problem. We have a dedicated pool of donors, and you know, they come in and they donate, but oftentimes if they've traveled, they are deferred. So we haven't had as many shortages as we have in the past. Usually shortages are due to a local event, such as the hurricane that we had last year, where New York City saw shortages because the donors couldn't get in to donate. Mm-hmm. But typically, from hospitals have reported that they usually don't have to postpone surgery, which is sort of the measure by which we measure a shortage, is if you've had to postpone your elective surgery or don't have enough of a certain type. But luckily, because red cells can be stored for so long, we're able to ship blood across the country pretty quickly if there's a dire need of a certain type.
Okay, and you mentioned type, which leads me to my next question to you again, Dr. Mondoro. What type of blood are usually available and those that are rarely available? I heard of the type O, that is the most common type of blood. Is this true for the world? Is this true just for the U.S.? Can you give us a sense of what
I can tell you about the U.S.? So, yes, type O with a positive Rh factor is the most common, and then the rarest type in the U.S., and I believe most generally, is AB negative.
Okay.
Type O negative is the universal red cell donor, so those donors are sought after because they can be received by the most types of patients.
Okay, and the universal recipient will be O plus?
The universal recipient would be AB.
Oh, AB, okay.
Yes, they have no antibodies in their blood.
So I hear a lot about the type O. What is it? Is it because it's very common or because the O negative is a universal donor?
Well, O has no antigens, which are certain types of sugars, on the red cells, and then they have anti-A and anti-B antibodies in their plasma. But it just so happens, at least in the United States, with the ethnicities that are present here, that O positive is the most prevalent in the population.
What is the case, Dr. Bellairs, in Western Cape? What is the most common type?
It's very similar to what's been described in the U.S. So the most common type here is group O positive. Just like elsewhere, group O negative donors are the most sought after because that can be used for anyone in an emergency situation. O negative we particularly designate for women who are still in the childbearing age, prevent sensitizing them and possibly threatening future pregnancies.
Okay. Now, at what point does one know it's a blood type, or should everyone know their blood types? I remember when I was in Africa, in my country, I had a little booklet with my blood type, and then I came here. Up until now, I have not had the opportunity, or I haven't been told what my blood type is. Is this something that need to be requested, perhaps, in Africa? What is the case, Dr. Bellair?
It's not routinely done on members of the general population. We do occasionally get people asking our service if we can test their blood type, and we'd happily do that. It's a relatively simple procedure, and, you know, we use automated platforms to do it. I still think there's probably little utility in it overall, because even if a person knew their blood type, in an emergency situation, we would still give them group O blood, even if they told us their type was, for instance, group A or group B or group AB. Or alternatively, if there was sufficient time, we would test their blood group at the time of ordering a transfusion.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's something that probably became popular through the military situations, where I think on the tags that soldiers wore around their necks or sometimes on their uniforms, they would have their blood type. But that's a different situation. We certainly generally wouldn't take a random person in the population's word for it what their blood type was. We'd always test that and confirm it.
Okay, and now, Dr. Mondoro, with regards to the U.S., as I said, I haven't had a chance, or perhaps I haven't been told yet my blood type. So what are the guidelines, or do I need to ask, or what is the case here?
Well, I think several years ago, I know that when I was an infant, when you were born, often the hospital would type your blood as an infant, but since I've had my own children, that is not being done anymore. I think the most frequent place that people learn of their blood type is when they go to donate. Then mm-hmm. they receive a donor card with their name and address, but it usually has their type on it that has been confirmed once they've donated blood. I think that's now the most common way that people learn of their type, and then they carry that card in their wallet. But again, I agree with what's being said. I don't think anyone would take their word for it. They would still be tested should they be immediate need of blood.
Okay, so I guess I just admitted that I haven't donated blood in the U.S. yet. That's why I don't know my type. Yeah. Well, I do know my type, but that's why I haven't been told here. So I will make up for it, Dr. Mondoro, I promise, because okay. I know it's a big deal here and everywhere to donate blood. So yes, I will become an advocate perhaps. Now, Professor Bates, let me come to you and ask, perhaps can you give us a general sense of the challenges with regards to blood donation? From the donor side, let's start with the donor side. What are some of the challenges?
I think certainly we have been struggling with our colleagues in Africa to try and get enough blood in the bank so that it can be available for surgery. And I know Dr. Mondoro mentioned that shortages are very unusual in the U.S., but in most of the African countries, shortages are a major, major problem. Mm-hmm. And there are many preventable deaths because there's not enough blood available in the transfusion service.
So from the recipient side, will it be then access to blood? Or are there other challenges on top of that?
From the recipient side, the major problem is accessing blood. But yeah. Initially, they have to get to a facility where they're able to have a blood transfusion. And in countries where the road networks are difficult, communications are difficult, many people are never able to access the hospital in the first place. And so it's a travesty, really, that once they get to the hospital, there is no blood in the bank for them. And that particularly applies to pregnant women and very young children who have a lot of anemia due to malaria. Mm-hmm. So those two groups are the biggest users of blood.
Okay, so you're saying children suffering from malaria and pregnant women are the most...
Yes, they're the biggest users of blood in Africa, and that situation is very different from the situation in wealthy countries where the majority of blood is used for example, surgery or cancer patients. And in wealthy countries, much of the blood is used in a planned way. You can predict how much you need. Whereas in Africa, much of the blood is given as an emergency, and it's much harder to plan your stocks when you don't know how much you're actually going to need.
And stocking is an issue indeed, because if perhaps it is an issue. Dr. Bellers, what are the, in terms of infrastructure to stock the blood, what do you have available?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
In terms of infrastructure, to be able to even have a stock of blood and keep
that... A stock of blood?
Yes.
Yeah, the infrastructure required is substantial. The first important thing is one has to make a decision on whether one processes blood into its components, i.e. red cells, platelets, and fresh frozen plasma components. And component therapy is the strategy followed in developed countries. In less developed countries, it may be that the strategy to be followed is simply to provide whole blood. In other words, blood is issued to patients in largely the same format as it's collected from donors. So if one chooses to do component therapy, there's substantial equipment and quality assurance and a whole lot of procedures involved. And thereafter, it needs to be stored in temperature-controlled environments. I won't go into the detail of what, but red cells, platelets, and plasma are all stored under different conditions and need to be very strictly temperature-controlled. And then one has to distribute through blood banks, which can either be sited in hospitals or freestanding. And that's the point at which cross-match testing occurs and blood is matched for an individual on clinician's request when they wish to treat a patient. So, at all levels, skilled staff required and significant resources, which is one of the challenges, I gather, that is faced by less developed countries.
Okay. Now we have some questions coming in, but we will take a very short break. And when we come back, we will have the questions for you, doctors and professor. I'll be right back. Don't go away.
Thank you.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis. We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Welcome back. If you're listening to the show on Health Chat today, we are discussing blood transfusion. Our guests are Professor Imelda Bates with the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. We also have Dr. Greg Belair with WP Blood Transfusion Services in South Africa, and Dr. Tracy Mondoro with the U.S. National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. Now we have a caller, Patrick. Welcome to the show.
Good evening, Mark. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening.
Hello. Yes, Doctor, I want to find out, there are two issues I want you to put me through. One, there was a case of a young man in Aba when I was in secondary school. He went and donated blood. They paid him and he gave him milk and bread to take. After taking this in the evening, the young man died after donating the blood. I want to find out, does it mean the people that collected that blood from the man didn't know the percentage of the blood in his body? And the second one happened in Jos. This was my boy. He went, he had a problem with blood. He went and donated. Do you know, after 3 hours, the young man started panting? Why must it be so? And the people are saying that people with A plus, it's always very hard to get their blood. I don't know
okay.
how to. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patrick, for your question. So I think the three of you can answer this question, but let me start with Dr. Mondoro. He talked about a young man who donated his blood and died later on in the evening. Do you see cases like this very often? What could have gone wrong?
I'm not really sure. So first of all, I'm not a physician. Let me put that out as a disclaimer. But I have not ever heard of anyone dying after donating blood. It would seem most likely that there was some other underlying problem, because you don't really receive anything during a donation. The blood is withdrawn from you with a sterile needle. So
okay.
I don't think I want to speculate.
Sure, sure. And perhaps, Professor Bates, do you have a possible explanation?
No, I agree with Dr. Mondoro that this would be extremely unusual for somebody to die after just donating one unit of blood.
Okay.
That's only one pint out of their whole blood volume, which is quite a small proportion. So it's very unlikely it would be that actually caused anyone to die.
Okay. Dr. Belair, a possibility, perhaps someone did not eat properly afterwards or was anemic before donating blood. Are there cases like this where someone, some side effects, even if it's not death, are there some side effects?
Yeah. Look, it's extremely unusual for anyone to, for someone who's donated to, blood to die. And it, to me, most of the cases that have occurred have either been where a person has fainted but been in a situation where they could have an accident, for instance, fainting while driving a car.
Mm-hmm.
Or alternatively, it could also be that they had an underlying condition that was not identified or they were not aware of, for instance, severe coronary artery disease.
Mm-hmm.
But I must emphasize that complications, well, certainly death as a result of blood donation, is extremely rare.
Okay.
I think when it does occur, invariably, you know, each individual case makes its way into the international literature as a case report. That's how rare it is. It's certainly not common. And touch wood, we haven't had a donor die from donating at our service. Well, I've been there for 11 years, and there have been no deaths in that time, and we collect about 150,000 units per annum. So you know, that's about 1.5 million donations incident-free regarding mortalities.
Okay. Now, we have a question from Miriam in Liberia. She would like to know, is it safer to get blood from a family member versus an unknown donor? Let's see, Professor Bates.
I think the short answer to that is no, because it's much better to have it from a donor who has been properly screened, as Dr. Belair was explaining, all of the screening tests that have to be done in order to ensure safety. And it's really important that whoever donates has all of those screening tests. Of course, it's good if the relatives can come and donate blood to the hospital blood bank, but still they must be screened properly.
Okay. And we have John from Sierra Leone. He says, I donated blood one time in the past, and I was given some crackers. A second time, when I went back, I was given nothing to eat. Is it very important to eat after donating blood? Dr. Bellers?
It is fairly important. What we insist on is that a person who wishes to donate blood has at least had something to eat or drink in the preceding 4 to 6 hours. That reduces the chance of them fainting. And we generally supply fruit juices, tea, coffee, and biscuits to all donors after donating. But I appreciate that in some countries that are perhaps less well-resourced, this might not always be possible. But in general, we think it's a good strategy to give a donor a small snack after donating. Mm-hmm. And biscuits and juice work well for us.
Okay. Akisi from Ghana wants to know, and this doctor, this question to you, Dr. Monduro, I will toss this to you. She says, do baby or children, small children, can they give blood? Can baby or small children give blood?
So, no, we don't advise that children under the age of 17 is the age that most states in the U.S. require that you be, but it's not just age that's important. It's your weight as well. As was mentioned earlier in the program, I believe that actually both the others talked about this. You can only tolerate losing so much fluid volume from your body. And when you're small, a baby or a small child, they just can't afford to lose the volume. It's very, very rare that we would allow a child to be a donor, and it's usually if they're sibling, if there has to be a matching of the antigens at a very deep level, that we would use a sibling donor. And I don't think babies are ever used.
Okay. This question from Paul, he says, in what cases do people need blood? I think perhaps you went over it, one of you went over it, but let's go down, let's clarify this. At what point do people need blood? Dr. Bellairs, perhaps you want to answer that?
Blood components really fall into three main categories. First are the red cell products, the second is platelet products, and the third are fresh frozen plasma or plasma products. And each of those is indicated for different reasons. But essentially, red cell concentrate is probably by far the most widely used blood product in blood transfusion, and it's usually given when a person's own hemoglobin concentration is too low to carry sufficient oxygen around their body. And that's for two main reasons. It either means they've lost blood, either through surgery or traumatic reasons, or a surgical emergency, for instance, a bleeding ulcer or an abdominal aortic aneurysm that's ruptured, or alternatively, they're not making sufficient red cells of their own. And an example of that would be aplastic anemia, okay, where their bone marrow isn't making red cells.
Okay. Well, I hate to interrupt. Unfortunately, we're running out of time.
That's fine.
I appreciate your time. Dr. Greg Bellairs, Professor Imelda Bates, and Dr. Tracy Monduro, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And that's all the time for today's Health Chat. If you want more, check us out on the website, voanews.com/healthchat. I'm your host, Lenore Mudu, in Washington, with producer Jackson Vunganyi. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.